everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about the books they write and the lives they lead and how these two things are one and the same. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And Author is funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA and their outstanding yearly conference, please go to pnwa.org. Well, I do not want to waste much time with an introduction today. I will say only that my guest, Sir Ken Robinson, is, in my opinion, one of the most eloquent and forward-looking speakers and writers on the subject of creativity, education, and human potential, and I am just as happy as can be to have him on the show today. Ken, welcome to Author.
It's a great pleasure, Bill. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it is my pleasure indeed. I mentioned your title is Sir Ken Robinson, which, unless I don't understand something, has to do... Well, you were knighted, is that correct?
That's correct, yes. It was 8 years ago.
Wow. Well, congratulations on that. And as I understand it, you received the knighthood largely for your work in education. Is that so?
Education and the arts, that's right, yes. It was. It's obviously a great privilege and a great honor. I wasn't expecting it, but you can't really apply for these things. You know.
you have to meet Her Highness?
Yes, or Her Majesty, of course, as we refer to her now. So.
Oh, excuse me.
I should say this, it's all rather complicated. I spent some time a few weeks ago in Ireland, my wife and I, with the Duke and Duchess, who you have to refer to as Your Grace. And so I don't think any of us really knows all these nuances unless you happen to work for one of the heritage companies. But yeah, it's you do. It's exactly what you think it's going to be. It's a morning at the palace, at Buckingham Palace, and...
Right.
Meeting the Queen and being touched on the shoulder with the sword. It was a wonderful day. It's actually like a rather grand commencement.
Yeah. Well, it sounds great. It sounds great. And what's interesting to me is when I interviewed you a little over a year ago now, maybe 2 years ago, for the release of the paperback release of The Element, which is a book, while it deals with education for sure, it is not... specifically about education. It's more about individuality and creativity and the potential of these two things. But to me, this idea of individuality and creativity and human potential flows very naturally from the river of education.
Well, that's right. There is a chapter in The Element about education, but you're quite right, Bill. It's not, the book isn't directly and exclusively about education, but it has quite considerable implications for education, which I try to draw out. The book is really about what it takes to discover your true talents and passions in your life.
Yeah.
I mean, the premise of it is that we all have deep talents and abilities, and that there are, broadly speaking, you know, I meet people all the time who don't enjoy what they do with their lives particularly. They may not enjoy what they do for a living particularly. They just get on and get through the week, and they're doing something they may have just wandered into, as it seems, by force of circumstance. But I also meet people who actually love what they do and couldn't imagine doing anything else. And that's true in my experience of a lot of writers. If you were to say to most professional writers, why don't you stop writing and do something else to change, they would look at you and wonder what you're talking about, because they'd say, well, this is who I am. It doesn't mean to say that it's all painless and every day is a kind of continuous joy of creative achievement. Often it's they're dragging themselves through all kinds of turmoil to get the work done, but to write is what they feel they were born to do. But I meet people who teach who would say that, people who work in industry. I mean, if you can think of an occupation or a way of spending your life, there'll be those who absolutely love it and those who couldn't imagine spending more than half an hour doing it. And it's that deep sense of individuality, of finding things that resonate with your real spirit, with who you are, that The Element's about. And the education implication is that very often, I believe, education does very little to connect people with their true talents, and in some cases actively deters them from it.
Yes. Yes, you know, I agree completely. And I was watching again the interview we had done when you came through with the book, and you talked about the two qualities you need to be sort of in your element, and it really reminded me of my own life, because the first quality you mentioned was having to be good at something, at what you're doing. And I had what turned out to be kind of a curse almost as a young man, which was that I was good at being good at things. Now, I know that sounds like bragging, but in fact,
I get that. Yeah.
It really isn't. I could, any hoop you presented to me, I was going to jump through it. It didn't matter if it was the hoop of physics or track and field or football or acting or writing. Any hoop, I was going to jump through it. And I was going to, if I could, jump through it better than the guy next to me. And that was all very well and good. It made school rather easy, of course, because that's what so much of school does. But it did not bring into the second quality, which is love, right?
Yeah.
You've got to keep love doing it.
That's the critical second point, really, that to be in your element, you do have to be good at something. I don't mean you have to be the best person in history, but you have to have a natural aptitude for something. You have to have a feel for it. You have to know what this is about. And, for some people, that may be algebra. I know people who came across mathematics as kids, and I thought, I absolutely get this. This isn't a problem. And other people who have a headache at the very thought of it. But then others who will walk into a basketball court and understand immediately what's required, and others who can't wait for the whistle to go because they just don't know, they don't get it. So it is partly about aptitude, and aptitude is too narrowly defined, I think, in education and for many of us in our own lives. But you're quite right. The second major factor is a love for it. If you love something you're good at, then, as they say, you never work again. And it's finding that meeting point between the two. And is that what happened in your life? Did you find that meeting point?
Oh, absolutely. And what was interesting was I just thought of writing was the thing I loved to do, for sure. But what even there, Ken, I had to learn to allow myself to write what I loved as opposed to anything that they would put before me. It wasn't enough merely to write. I had to write what interested me most, the thing I most wanted to say. Because, again, I would see all these different writing things I could write as more hoops that I could jump through. And it wasn't enough. I had to write what I loved. In fact, there's a great quote. I don't know it exactly. I don't know the first half exactly, but it's by Mozart. And he said, genius isn't talent. It isn't skill. It is love, 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 love. That's what Mozart said.
Yeah, because an early draft of the Beatles, of course.
As
we think of Mozart these days.
Yeah.
No, that is right. Love is not all you need, but you do need it. I mean, to be in your element. But you also do need, a natural feel for it. A talent of some sort. But one is not enough without the other. That's really the point.
Yeah.
And I know that's the case in all the work I've done. And one of the ways you can tell when you're in your element is that your energy shifts and with it your sense of time. If you're doing things that you don't care for, 5 minutes can feel like an hour. But if you're doing something you love, the common experience is you look up and it may be an hour later and you think it's been 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Because you become so immersed in it. It's what the psychologist Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, who thankfully we can refer to as Mike, when we meet him socially,
right?
He refers to it as flow, and other people call it being in the zone. But it's that sense of total absorption, where you feel a complete unity with the task, where you're completely focused on it, and almost to the distraction of everything else.
Yes.
That's when you can really tell.
Absolutely. And I was lecturing recently about writing, and I said of it, and I really believe this is, people choose to write, among other things, but choose to write because it's not easy. And by easy, I mean it doesn't require your full attention, like driving a car where you can drive and have a conversation. Or even like having a conversation, sadly, you can have a conversation and not give it your full attention. But to write successfully, you have to give it your full attention. You can't think about the future. You can't worry about the past. You have to be absolutely present for the thing for it to really flow. And for me, in my own life, I have never been so happy when I give life my full attention, because then I'm present. Now, you, for instance, you recently, I saw you speaking with Eckhart Tolle on Tolle TV, I think it was.
Yes,
and that's the man TV. Obviously preaches the present moment.
Yeah.
And it's been the case for me.
I think it is about that. It's about being fully present, being in the here and now. And you find that, of course, in other areas too. I mean,
sure.
if you're involved in sports or you're a real musician, the common experience is of being fully invested in the thing that you're doing.
Yeah.
I was intrigued too, by the way, when you talked about finding the right sort of writing.
Yeah.
For some people, it's fiction, and it's not particular fiction. It's certain sorts of fiction. For
some
people, it may be documentary writing, or they're into news journalism or documentary journalism, or it's poetry. It's not prose. Mm-hmm. Now, my wife Terry is a writer. She published a novel earlier this year called India's Summer, it's doing. I'm really thrilled with it. In some ways, it's the fiction version of The Element. It didn't start out like that. She was working with me in the early days of The Element. In fact, it was Terry that pushed me to do the book because I think I mentioned it in the introduction to the book. I was giving a talk at a conference in Los Angeles, and I told the story. I actually told it at one of the TED conferences about
this is the dancer,
Julian Lin. Yes, and I was telling that story about this little girl how she discovered her talent as a dancer, and at the end of it. Terry, who was there with me, said, you know, at the end of the talk, I said, you know, I'm going to write a book about these stories at some point. And I came off stage, and Terry said, when are you going to write that book?
Uh-huh.
And I said, don't be ridiculous. It was a rhetorical flourish. it was my kind of crescendo.
Right.
I said, no, you have to write that book.
Yeah.
And I said, no, I do. And so I kept putting it off, as you often do when you're writing, and Terry got started with it, and shamed me eventually into doing it. But as we were interviewing people for the book, it came in on her that she herself was getting a bit depressed by all these people who were describing their
doing
element. Doing what they love to do. And she, like you, Terry's good at all kinds of things.
Yeah.
And does them all very well. But she didn't feel that she devoted herself to this particular search for element. And we talked a lot about it. And it's often the case, isn't it, that the thing you love most is hiding in plain sight. And the fact is, she'd been writing all her life, and it was the thing that she got most absorbed in. And we all encouraged her, well, you should be writing. And she, you know, after having come all this way and had found that she could find some time to do it now, and she started on this novel that took her 2 years. We all paid a very high price for it, as you do.
This is how it goes.
We never saw it. We're all eating scraps from the floor, you know, for 2 years and living in general squalor because you disappear for 12 hours at a time and then reappear and say, hey, is it time for breakfast yet? And we say, well, it's actually supper now.
Right.
Because she became so absorbed. But for her, the whole thing is not just fiction, but women's fiction, women's fiction. And she says that she just dwells in the world that she's created, and she wakes up fascinated to know what's going to happen to these characters. And when she finished the book, she got very lonely because she missed them all.
That's a good sign.
The book came out, and she's now on the sequel. So we've had a short respite where we've all been eating properly.
Well, that is great.
Yeah,
that is great. And you know, this is one I talk to writers all the time and about writing, and I believe firmly you've got to find. I mean, there are people who can write across the genres, but far more people need to find that thing that really calls to them. Maury Sendak just passed away today, and I watched a video.
Oh, I didn't know that. I missed that.
Yeah, he passed away this morning, I guess, or late last night or something. I watched a video of him talking about, he said, I've had a lot of adult experiences. He's a very articulate man, but he said, I don't want to write about them. My heart is still in childhood, and so that's where his writing remained. I think that's what you've got to do. It certainly was true for me. The difference, I will tell you, between writing something you really want to write and love to write and writing something you simply can write, because, of course, I have a lot of skill at it, and that's all very well and good. But simply applying skill to something, and the way I describe it is this, is to say something just as close as you can to getting just right. You never get it just right, but you can come very close. We usually require some patience. And if you are authentically, personally interested in expressing that, you will wait. You will wait because you want to see it, not because you want the money or the accolades, but because you want to see it.
That's right.
And then everything else will come afterwards.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And my experience, it's often, you know, that line that's frequently quoted from Alice in Wonderland, that, you know, where she says that, you know, how do I know what I think until I hear what I say?
Right.
That often the thought or the idea that you're groping for doesn't really come into very clear focus until you've found the exact way to express it.
Yes.
And I find that when I write, I mean, I don't write fiction, and I greatly admire people who do. I write what I know about, and I mean, I think all writers should do that. I mean, all fiction writers should do that. But I write nonfiction about the kinds of issues that we're talking about. I often say, I think it's true of a lot of writers, that it's not so much that I enjoy the process of writing. I think Carrie and I are different from that point of view. She actually loves the process.
Right.
I love it sometimes, but I always love having written.
Yes.
You know, because I struggle for it, but if I feel I've really helped to crystallize something, and I think, well, I don't think I could say that any better than that.
Right.
That's a wonderful feeling, you know, and you want to go back and reread it again and pat yourself on the back that you've captured it. It's what Orwell always talked about writing being translucent. And I think if you can do that, a great deal of writing, particularly non-fiction writing, is not very good writing in my experience.
Some of it can be really dreadful.
Yeah,
I started out writing fiction for years. I've now moved to nonfiction, and I adore it, though it's like memoir-y kind of philosophical stuff. So it has a narrative feel to it. But I find that it doesn't matter because, to me, even in the nonfiction stuff, if it's more essay-like, I still am applying the same imagination because, for me, I don't know if this is true of you, Ken, but even when I'm speaking, the knowledge comes to me first as a sort of feeling, and then I have to see it. I know that's odd, but I have to see it in my imagination to give it some form that I can translate into language.
Yes.
And it's the seeing that I really know it. I know it as a feeling, and then I know it as something I can see and translate into words. And that, to me, is what writing is about.
Yes. I'm always fascinated by the relationship between language and thought. I remember one of the great revelations to me as a student. You know, you occasionally come across these ideas that just light you up.
Mm-hmm.
As a student, I did a course on language and learning. And, I mean, up until that point, like most people, I imagine, I had a fairly kind of naive, taken-for-granted view of language, which was that you know, you have an idea, then you put it into words, and you communicate it that way. So that language is really a kind of just a transactional mode for an idea you've already formed. And the great weight of evidence now is, and this is what came through the course we did, where we looked at the work of people like, you know, Vygotsky and Sapir and Benjamin Wolf and Piaget and others, is that language isn't just how we communicate ideas, but it interpenetrates how we formulate them, and therefore the ideas that we actually have, and that some objects, I mean, if you have a chair, well, all languages have words for chairs of various sorts. I mean, it doesn't affect the actual thing. But when you start to talk about relationships and modes and values and concepts and ideas, of course, the language at your disposal greatly affect your entire worldview. You know, some languages have subjunctive modes, some don't. Some have imperfect tenses, some don't.
Yeah.
All languages have different grammatical structures, and they affect what you can say in certain languages. And some things are hard to think in certain languages. It's always interesting to me speaking to people who are...
You speak more than one language?
I speak a bit of French.
Yeah, that's all I speak is a little bit of French, but not anymore, really.
No, I used to. In fact, we've just come back from France, and my wife and Terry and I are thinking of getting more heavily into it now. But you know, it's the case that in different languages, some ideas become more apparent and are not really comprehensible in certain sorts of languages. So there's a very dynamic relationship between language and thought. That's my point, really. And that of course, when if you're writing, it isn't just a question of putting down on the page what you're thinking. It's a question of the process of actually crystallizing, clarifying in the process of writing what it is you're trying to convey and conceive of.
Yes, absolutely. And the thing I have come to understand as I've become more mature as a writer is I've come to stop thinking about the words so much, that most of what I spend my time doing, I call it focusing the telescope in my mind. It's if I see the idea at a distance, even if it's an idea or a scene or something, I see it at a distance, and then I spend most of my time simply focusing that lens so I can see it clearly, because I can't write it. How can you write it until you can see it? You have to distinguish it from the thing next to it, you know, the idea similar to it, but that's not it. And so I have learned as a writer, patience being so important, to wait and wait. Don't think about words. Don't put any words down until you begin to see it so clearly or feel it so clearly. And then, because I'm sort of like a musician who's trained on scales over and over and over again, once I can see it, then the words come very quickly. Although it looks like they come slowly, but they don't. They come quickly once I give the word to my brain, my language, you know, part of myself. Okay, now language, come. And then it comes, but I have to see the thing first.
That's very
interesting. More and more I come to see writing as seeing more than...
Well, it's interesting to me because, of course, there are some things that can be put into words. I mean, it doesn't matter how deft you are with language. There are some things, though, that remain elusive to words. The other great revelation I felt when I was younger was that it doesn't mean that we're inarticulate about these things, but we turn to other modes. There are some ideas that can only really be expressed in music or in movement or in art, you know, that when, as somebody once put it, you know, when words are silent, music may speak. And I remember, I think somewhere in The Element, I quote I think it's the case of Mahler, who was working on a new piece of music. And there was a student sitting at the back and listened to him play. And at the end of it, he said, "Maestro, that was absolutely marvelous. So what's this new piece about?" And Mahler said, "Oh, yes," he said, "it's about this." And he played it again.
Right. Yes. Yes.
If there'd been some way of putting it some other way, he would have used that other way.
That's right. So
words certainly speak in some areas more clearly than any other mode, and in some not so clearly.
Well, you know, when I was about 42, I'm 47 as of a week ago today.
Congratulations.
And when I was about 42, 43, I taught myself to compose. I'd been wanting to do it all my life, and so I finally did it. And I have to say, learning to compose, or little orchestral pieces and so on, taught me a lot about writing. I know it sounds weird, but it taught me to tune in to what I wanted to hear.
Yes.
And then translate it. And what I would not worry about meaning so much, but just about feeling and intention. And I know it sounds odd, but I felt like I became a much better writer once I learned how to compose music. That the two were so
close.
Sure,
that's right.
Yes,
that's right. And getting the sense of rhythm and form. I've actually just, there's a book coming out next year, and I was sent a copy to offer some blurb, you know, some opening sentences for it to endorse it. I think it's a wonderful book. It's called The Lost Carving. And it's by a man called David Esterly, who is a woodcarver. And I just think it's a wonderful book. Excuse me, I've got phones ringing in the background.
Yeah, I know, you're a popular man.
But it's been published by Viking. It's called The Lost Carving, and he's a woodcarver who worked in the tradition of a man I'd never heard of, actually, truth. It's not my field, called Grinling Gibbons, who is a 17th century carver, who has had a tremendous gift for producing, reproducing foliage and leaves and flowers and you know, the natural world in carved wood. And his pieces are in great homes and cathedrals all over Europe. Actually, wonderful stuff. I mean, you really feel you could see the dew forming on these things. And David Esterly saw one of these pieces and actually was captivated and taught himself the craft. And when there was a fire at Hampton Court in London, the story tells the book, he was eventually asked to replace one of these carvings by Grinling Gibbons, who was his great hero. But what's interesting to me is that, firstly, the book is about a fascinating subject. It's full of extraordinary images. It's also beautifully written. And David Esterly is a scholar as well as being a sculptor. But what interests me is I said in my blurb, he writes as he carves, in a way, you know, with an inherent sense of form and structure, with wonderful use of metaphor, and a very incisive sense of style. And you find that often, that people who work in, like you're saying, that your work in music has influenced for the good your writing.
Yeah.
That in a way, the principles of style apply in all sorts of different fields equally strongly, don't they? The same.
Oh, absolutely. I did theater. And I love to act, and what I learned doing theater in terms of as a to find the character and be present and allow the character to speak through me, you have to let go in order to, you can't think your character, you have to sort of be the character. And so much of writing is letting go of a certain, even in nonfiction writing, I find, it's very, very close. And the artistic disciplines, for sure. You know, it's interesting, I want to go back to something you said about love and the arts. The arts are unusual in one particular way from a lot of other fields. I speak having worked in other fields and spoken to a lot of people who were, say, doctors and lawyers in particular.
Yeah.
Who then go on to write. You can be a lawyer and not love the law, or be but make a very nice living at it, for sure, and probably even garner a lot of sort of prestige and so on, if that means anything to you. But in my experience with writing and all the arts, and this is why they talk about how, quote, hard the arts are, I just think they're talking about this one fact. You cannot do it successfully unless you love to do it. I simply don't think it's possible. There's some part of you has to be willing to do it for free. No one, very few people, I was a bartender. I can tell you right now I would not be a bartender for free. I would certainly be a waiter for free. There's a lot of jobs I did. I wouldn't do one moment for free, but I have done writing for free for many years, and I would continue to do it even if no one ever paid me to do it. And I think most of the arts, you kind of have to. It's weird. It's unusual in that way, but I think it's true of acting, everything, all of them, really. You get paid eventually a lot of times, but not always.
But, you know, I think you're right, but I think though that's an indication of being in your element. I think there are many other areas that people will do for free.
Absolutely.
I mean, I know amateur scientists, amateur in the proper sense of the word, of doing it for the love of it. You know, amateur physicists, people who work in the community, work with children, they'll maybe even be a barman because they just love it. They just love it. And they do it for free. If you do it for free, it's a good sign that you're in your element. Not infallibly so. You may just be very charitable.
Right.
But very often people say, you know, I can't believe I'm being paid for it. Yeah. And by the way, I'm just actually putting the finishing touches, I hope, to the sequel to The Element.
Yeah.
Which is out this time next year. I keep being asked since the book came out, this is all great, but how do I find my element then?
So this is about finding your element.
Well, for the first year or so, I treated these inquiries with a cheery wave of the arm. You know, so don't worry about it. Just read the book again. But it was never meant to be a practical guide. And I realized in due course I really owed people answers to that. So, yes, the new book is provisionally called Finding Your Element.
Yeah.
And it's about what steps you can take if you don't know what your element is to help to find it.
Do you feel, we have about 5 minutes left or so, do you feel like you were able to, that's a tricky thing to try and teach people. There's teachers the world over, you know, who focused their life on that very subject. Did you feel happy with what you were able to discover in terms of how to communicate and guide, point? Because you can't tell people. You can only sort of point them towards it in a way.
That's exactly the point, yes. It's not a 10-step program. I actually say in the introduction, I mean, there are 10 chapters in the book, as it turns out, but it's not a 10-step program. I can't guarantee by chapter 10 you'll be in your element because it's up to you. It's about whether you're prepared to do what's involved. And in the end, it comes back to something you were saying right at the beginning about individuality. You know, one of my arguments in the book is that, you know, and it's a clear enough point to make, is that every human life is different and unique. I mean, biologically, you know, we all carry the traces of our own families and ancestors and forebears. And, I mean, I'm very much like my father in lots of ways, but I'm not a clone. Many things I think are unique to me turned out to be true of him too, but also of my mother. You know, so we're all a unique biological mix. We reach a unique moment in history, but we all have different experiences too, different cultural experiences. So it means that every life lived is different from every other life. And so you can't tell people what their element is. What you can help them do is take the journey. And it's really a two-way journey, I think. It's an internal journey to discover more about yourself, to spend time with yourself. And I think people spend too little time now on internal reflection. But it's also an outward journey to discover more of the world around you and the opportunities that may reveal things to yourself that you didn't know about. So you're right. You can offer people signposts. You can offer them encouragement. You can offer them the lessons of others who have gone before. You can give them principles and techniques and resources. And I do all of that in the book. But in the end, it's like all journeys. It's one you have to take for yourself.
Well, Ken, I've heard a little bird just told me our time is up. I hope I get to talk to you when that when that comes through, when you come through next year, will you come and join me?
I would love to, yes.
All right. Well, Ken, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much.
And thank you all for listening. It's been great having you on. What a great show. And we'll see you next week when I believe we have Bob DeGoni, Robert DeGoni, suspense writer. Thank you. Do what you love.